Charles Weygandt, and I am in the office of Walter Scann at the Maryland Historical Society. Today is Lincoln's birthday, February the 12th, 1976, and I have with me Clarence Mitchell, Jr., director of the Washington office, the NAACP, since 1950. Mr. Mitchell, you were born in the pre-World War I era, when the civil rights gains of the Reconstruction period were being whittled away. As a matter of fact, at that time, the Democrats were trying to disfranchise the blacks. So I would like to know when you first became conscious of racial discrimination as a child, because you came into the world at a very disadvantageous time for blacks in this country.
Yes, well, I was born March 8, 1911, and as you say, that was the period when the Reconstruction gains were being destroyed. I did not become conscious of racial discrimination, I suppose, until I must have been somewhere in the fourth or fifth grade of school. I had there a school principal whose name was George B. Murphy and was out of the Murphy family, which owns the Afro-American, and he had a tendency to try to get the children advised on things that had to do with race. There was also a teacher there, Miss Handy, who was the daughter of a very famous African Methodist bishop, and there were other people like that who from time to time would talk about the role of blacks in our country. I remember there was a Miss Sorrell who...
how do you spell that?
S-O-R-R-E-L-L.
Okay.
And she was a person who talked about having seen Frederick Douglass, for example, when he came to Baltimore to speak on something. Then, of course, as you moved around in your everyday life, you were bound to run into something that might make an impression on you. I remember on one occasion we were on a streetcar going down Carey Street. That was a car which went from somewhere up at the car barn in those days down to Fort McHenry. And as children, we would go to Fort McHenry. I had an older sister who was a communist. And there was a white man on the car sitting several seats ahead of us who apparently didn't like the idea of some reason of his children being on the car. In those days the windows were open and he continued to spit out of the window in a way that would cause the moisture to fly back. Just that my sister, who was older, of course, objected to it, and I guess somebody finally stopped it, but it was just one of those little nasty things that people do, you know. Then on another occasion when I was older, I would go to the band concerts at the Dirt Hill Park. At that time, that was a type of recreation that I suppose a great many people were interested in because it was always crowded. And I sat in a seat that I'd been sitting in some time when I heard this commotion off to my right. And this lady was getting up saying, "I'm not going to sit by an old nigger tonight." Well, I didn't know what she was talking about at the time, but it turned out what she was objecting to was my sitting in the seat that I was occupying. Her husband, who seemed to be a little more reasonable, tried to quiet her down, but he didn't succeed. Her parting shot, as I remember it, was, "The police will be here to get you." But I didn't move. And then,
well, how did you feel, though?
Well, frankly, it happened so suddenly, and I was so interested in the concert. It really didn't make much of an impression on me, but the thing that did make an impression on me was a hand. And it came on my shoulder, just gently patting it, and saying, "I want to commend you for acting like a gentleman." But it never occurred to me that I was acting like a gentleman. I guess I was too surprised to retaliate or say anything.
Who was the person that said that?
Unhappily, I didn't ever turn around. I know it was a white person. And I'm always sorry that I didn't, because that little gesture meant so much at that time, you know. And I can't honestly say that it had any kind of a traumatic effect on me, because it just seemed, her conduct seemed so foolish, but it was quite obviously race-related.
But when you were in school, were you taught by the teachers to accept, more or less accept the conditions that then existed, or what was the prevailing opinion that you were learning as you were growing up?
Well, I think I had very good teachers who didn't stress so much what your handicaps were. They talked more in terms of the world in which we live and the history of the country, so that I really never felt that I wasn't an American by right. For example, I can remember on one occasion when we had exhibits, and I was trying to get an exhibit which had to do with the production of cocoa. This teacher that I had got me to write for the Baker Chocolate Company, I think it was. To my amazement, they sent an elaborate exhibit with cocoa beans and very finished little cabinets, all sorts of things which I'm sure they must have sent to any school child who asked for it. Then I can remember my principal having me give a lecture on World War I. I think by that time I was in the seventh grade, and he had me review all. It didn't really start with the principal, it started with the teacher who was teaching in that course. And they had me review all the events that led up to World War I, and they had a map in the auditorium. And as a child, of course, to be given the accoutrements of a faculty member was quite an impressive experience. They gave me a pointer, you know, and some things to make lines with. So it really was an enjoyable experience. And again, I, of course, was thoroughly indoctrinated with the position of our country in that conflict, and thought about it as us against them, you know.
Right.
It didn't have any racial overtones. I can't honestly say that our teachers, to my best recollection, tried to instill in us any particular philosophy of accepting a second-class status. They were, for the most part, devoted to excellence per se. They would talk about the importance of study and the importance of preserving beauty. We always had these Arbor Day celebrations, you know, where you planted trees. And, of course, coming in out of a poor, very poor background, where you couldn't afford to buy things like seeds or turf, perhaps, and indeed living in an area where it probably wouldn't have grown anyway if you had the money, I learned very early to appreciate beauty from them. But in addition, I got a lot of it from my parents, and we would make do with whatever we had, you know, things like whitewashing the fence. My mother used to prepare a compound, I forget what it was called, which made the bricks red. And then we would plant what I later found out was, I believe, milkweed. But we called it snow on the mountain. And it was a prolific grower. It also looked very nice if you planted it. So we did that. And I also remember that my neighbor, our neighbor, whose husband I think was a caterer at that time, although later he lost his business, had the good fortune to have a grapevine in her yard. One of the things I always hoped for was the time that I would grow these purple grapes in my yard. Of course, by the time I got to a position where I could do it, it lost its fascination, but that was a childhood memory.
Well, what motivated you to assume the struggle for civil rights as a career?
Well, I think that it was a combination of things. After I got into college, I had more of a perception of what our problems were. One thing, again, as for most of my life, I was blessed with having people teaching who really cared not only about most of the students, but about me as an individual. And there was a Professor Robert Labery at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, that's L-A-B-A-R-E-E, who had been a missionary to Persia and had lived a great part of his life in what were then colonial areas. I'm not sure whether he had a son, but if he did, I think his son had moved away. And he, Morris, took me in as a son, not living in his house, but going to different things. Mm-hmm. And he saw to it that I got involved in so many different types of things which really were social problems. For example, he had me exposed to the role of the coal and iron police up in Pennsylvania, which at that time was a group of constabulary hired really by the coal and iron companies who had police functions. And then, of course, he had me doing debating on the question whether you could have compulsory unemployment insurance and things of that sort.
By the way, what were you majoring in?
At that time, I was taking everything they offered. I took all the science courses that I could get. I took comparative religions. I think, as I look back on it, it was really what a liberal arts course is supposed to be. And I must say, I enjoyed it. His courses were sociology, anthropology, comparative religions, and I can't remember all the others that he had, but whatever he taught, it really brought you home to the social concepts and the problems of our times as we were experiencing them, because that was 1929. I went into college in 28 and 29, and of course the Depression hit. So that these things were very pertinent at that time.
How did you raise the, you came from fairly modest circumstances, how did you, how were you able to go to college? Were you working?
I had worked all my life, it seemed, and enjoyed it. I would often have at least two jobs, and then I had, as a boy, I had a little, kind of a child's business of hauling ice and coal for neighborhoods and neighbors. Then I worked in the summers. I had on one occasion a job down at a place called the Tin Decorating Company, which is here. I don't know whether it's still owned locally or not, but anyway, it was down on the waterfront. And I would go there at, I guess I was doing a job at 7 in the morning. Then I would go to, after I left there, to a place up on Pennsylvania Avenue and McMeekin Street, which is known as Greb's. It was a confectionery store, and I would work there from about 6 until about 3 in the morning. Interestingly, at that time, it wasn't any great problem because I was young and vigorous, and the streets were safe, or seemed to be. Nobody ever bothered me going back and forth to my home. And in that way, I was able to save money, although there came times when we had real rough sledding with respect to getting money to go to school. And on one occasion, I just thought that was the end. I had saved my money, but we had to use it for something else. And I think this was in my second year. But whenever it was, for some reason, I decided I'd go up and have one last look around the place. I thought that meant I'd have to drop out. But an interesting thing happened. One of my schoolmates, who was a class or two ahead of me, said, "Don't think about dropping out." He said, "The people who are in charge of the business of this school understand what's going on. Go in and talk with them." So I went in and talked with Mr. Labery and another professor up there, Harold Grimm, like Grimm's Fairy Tales. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you go to school and you can pay as you get money to pay. So I did, and I finished really owing them a bill. And an interesting thing happened at that time. My mother, of course, had set great store by the graduation. And there was a pastor of a church, Reverend C.Y. Trigg, who had a car. He brought my mother up and for the class night.
A Baltimore minister?
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
T-R-I-G-G.
Okay.
He was the pastor of what is called Metropolitan Methodist Church, which is over on Landvale in Carolina.
Where Frank Williams was at one time?
That's right. See, I was raised as an Episcopalian, but when I finished college, I went to the Methodist Church quite a lot because we lived near there, and then later, after I got married, I joined it. Well, I guess I joined it before, but anyway, my wife had the influence there on my joining it. But this pastor brought my mother up to the class night. I could participate in the class night because there wasn't any requirement that you have paid your bill. But I couldn't participate in the graduation, so my mother came up and had all the flavor of graduation with the students in their robes and the gowns or whatever paraphernalia you wore in those days. And then the next day, I just had to stand around and watch my classmates get their diplomas because I hadn't paid my bill, and I didn't think there was anything unfair about it. I was glad to finish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Did you go to law school shortly thereafter?
No, I didn't go to law school until a long time afterward, actually. When I first came out, I got a job at the Afro-American newspaper as a reporter. I considered myself very lucky because people just didn't have work in those days. And nobody in professions was making much money. Doctors got along largely because their wives were teaching school. I don't know how the lawyers got along, because most of them were dead broke. And this job, which was a job made possible by the Blue Eagle, Roosevelt Blue Eagle program. I got at the Afro-American for $15 a week and thought I was very fortunate.
Now, in 1933, you were in Salisbury.
Princess Anne.
Princess Anne, excuse me. 1931 was Salisbury. 1933, you were Princess Anne.
Yeah, I was still in school when it started.
And what did you see when you were down in Princess Anne?
Well, in Princess Anne, which, as I said, was 1933, I saw this lynching.
You didn't actually see the lynching take place now, did
well,
you?
Well, we got there right after it happened. The crowd was still there. Body
did,
was
how
still
did you know that it was kind of, it's just by coincidence that you happened to come along?
No. It had been well publicized, actually, what happened. The victim,
well, you don't publicize a lynching.
But in those days,
you knew when something was in the offing.
It operated on a schedule which was announced on the radio.
Oh, come on.
That is correct. Actually, what happened.
You mean everybody knew when the thing was going to take place? And
oh,
the
sure.
Authorities didn't take adequate steps to prevent it?
They might have gone through the motions, but they didn't take adequate steps. You see, in a situation such as that, the victim had been brought to Baltimore while he was still alive, of course, for safekeeping. He was supposed to have molested an elderly white woman on one of those farms or in some part of the area surrounding Princess Anne. Also, the story has it that he was feeble-minded, but be that as it may, whatever happened, it aroused such antagonism. And he was brought to Baltimore City for safekeeping. And Governor Albert C. Ritchie was governor at that time. He was urged to send this man back on the ground that it was a reflection on the people in Princess Anne to say that anything would happen and that he should be sent back. Well, it turned out that because 2 years before in Salisbury there had been a lynching, anybody with his common sense should have known that it was hazardous to send this person back. But the Eastern Shore then was an important political entity, and I assume the governor didn't want to antagonize him any more than he already had, or any more than they had been antagonized by whoever brought the victim away. So there were these announcements that came over the radio. In those days, radio was much more primitive than it is now, but it was sufficient for you to know what was happening. And the team that was supposed to go down there from the Afro-American was supposed to start when the word came out that the crowd had gathered and the lynching was about to take place.
And you mean everybody knew it was going to take place? Well, why did the governor send him?
They knew that something would happen, and the something that everybody expected was a lynching.
Yeah.
And that is the reason why we went. The Baltimore Sun had its newspaper reporters down there. And we had to go a long way around, you know, at that time, up over through Havre de Grace, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, whatever way it was, we had to go around, and all the way, of course, we were picking up these reports of what was happening. Somebody gave me a pistol. I'd never fired a pistol in my life, so I stuck it down in the upholstery of the seat. I don't know what happened to it, whether anybody ever found it or not, but anyway. When we got down there, the crowd was there. They had actually completed the lynching at the time, but the body was...
They shoot him or hang him?
They hanged and then poured gasoline on the body and set it on fire. And it was right out there in the middle of the street. It was a horrible sight with all these people standing around. And
was it fire out when you got there then?
My recollection is that the fire was out, but the body was still in a state of singe, you know. And the interesting thing, too, was at that time, the crowd must have been more or less surfeited because they were standing around, but being young and brash, I went around asking people questions.
How'd you feel, though, when you saw this?
Well, it was a revolting sight. There's no doubt about that. I see a fellow human lying there in the middle of the street in that kind of a condition. It was terrible.
He was lying on the street then?
Yes. See, by that time he'd been cut down by somebody. I suppose all it might have just burned down because the body was saturated with gasoline, and maybe that the gasoline just burned the road. I doubt whether anybody was taking the trouble to give him any respectful attention. And we went around asking people.
You were asking these rednecks.
Yes, everybody. Well, the point
was... You weren't scared?
Well, now, at that time, as I said, when you're young, you have a lot of foolish notions. Somehow, it seemed to me, in the status of a reporter, that people would not bother you, that you had a kind of immunity to violence, which I...
Was it obvious that you were a reporter?
Well, I had my press card and my hat, and other reporters were milling around. But at the time, that was the worst thing I could have done because the crowd was very much annoyed with the whole press. I didn't realize it, of course. And
What kind of response did you get from these people?
Well, generally, nobody knew anything. They said that, a lot of people came over here from Virginia, and the people who did this, we don't know anything about it. And, I remember... We had one photographer with us, Paul Henderson, and there was a man who came up and looked at this body, a white man, and I was asking him a question or two. Paul Henderson tried to get his picture. This man was smart enough to move out of the way, you know, so he would never be in focus. Paul, I don't know whether he had anything to do with it or not, he might have been just there out of sympathy. But Paul said he probably was one of those who was involved in it. Well, when we came back, I must say that it was a kind of experience you don't forget, and to indicate the seriousness of what the situation was. About a month or so later, there was a disturbance in that same community, and a great many of the blacks were chased out of the town. A large number of reporters, and these were white reporters, were chased into a hotel. The hotel was set on fire.
Really?
Yes, the Sun reported. But I had this interesting little experience. I went down to cover it, of course, and that time I was alone, or maybe somebody dropped me. I don't remember how I got there, but it was only one train a day out of there. So I stayed at the home of Dr. C.L. Kaya, K-I-A-H, with that his Mrs. Yeah. Kaya's father-in-law, who was at that time the head of the Princess Anne Academy. So I stayed there overnight, and the next morning we were out on the street. The sheriff, who knew Dr. Kaya, came up, and Dr. Kaya introduced me to the sheriff. But he didn't say I was a reporter. So the sheriff said, yes, if we could just stop these damn reporters from coming in here, giving out of town a bad name. Needless to say, I didn't indicate that I was connected with the press. But then Dr. Kaya left me, and I was on my own, and I went to the place where some of these people who had caused the disturbance were supposed to be on trial. I had only been used to the courtroom situation as you find in Baltimore, you know, where you have a regular courtroom with seats and that kind of thing. But this place where the people were brought in, and these were whites who were charged with creating the disturbance, this place was jammed. Everybody was standing up. It was seemingly a little office. And just you had to push your way in to get in. So I must say that it didn't seem to be the safest place in the world to be, so I was hesitant about going in. When there was a little argument among blacks who were standing on outside. One fellow who had a few drinks, I think, said, if I could just get one person to go in there with me, I'd go in. And they called him Monk. So I said, well, I'm going in there. Will you go with me? And all his friends, of course, called his bluff that he couldn't back out. But he got in there, and the first thing he did was stepped on a white man's foot. Well, you can imagine what happened. This white man looked at him and said, nigga, I'll kill you. You stepped on my foot. And he didn't say anything to me. He sort of looked me over, but he said this directly to Monk. And while Monk was making his excuses, another white man stepped up and said, Monk, I've got a package over at the station. Why don't you go over there and pick it up for me? Well, that got Monk out of the line of fire, but left me in there in that uncomfortable position. I couldn't figure out what was happening. It seemed to me that they were giving these fellows a lecture. I don't think anything much was done to them. So we all left, and then I went over to the station to catch this one train a day out. I must say that was the longest wait I could imagine. I was mighty glad when it came, and I went up to Delaware, I guess it was, to get back.
All right, I think we got a little bit more on this tape. Well, when did you leave the Afro then?
I left the Afro, I think it was in 36, perhaps. Before that, of course, I had been assigned to cover the Scottsboro trial twice. But I left the Afro, I guess it was 36, because I got a fellowship to study at the Atlanta School of Social Work. It was an Urban League fellowship, and I was down in Atlanta. I lived down there for a year.
Do you have any comments you want to make about the Scottsboro trial?
Well, that was another very interesting experience, because I had read about it in school. You see, the incident began in 31, and it was widely publicized, so I knew about it, but it never occurred to me while I was in school that I would be on the scene of the actual trial. And it was a very amazing experience to me, because while I had always been poor and came up in real poverty, I wasn't quite prepared for what the poverty level was down there in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I was living with some people who were very nice people, but also very poor. And then, of course, I wasn't quite prepared for the rigidity of segregation as it struck you in that situation. Newspaper people were segregated, and the whole atmosphere was one of hostility. But again, as I said, when you're young, you do things that you probably wouldn't do when you're older. It occurred to me that it might be a good story to interview the judge, and I did. The judge was furious because I said, you know, I had been at the Armwood lynching in Princess Anne, and I felt that the atmosphere down there in that little town of Decatur then wasn't much different from what Princess Anne was. So I asked him what precautions were being taken to prevent lynchings and that kind of thing. And as I said, he was curious. He said, well, there's not going to be any lynching down here unless some of you reporters start it. And afterwards, some people told me the judge had toyed with the idea of finding me in contempt.
Oh, really?
But hadn't done anything about it. I guess he was conscious of the possibility of making something out of nothing. But in any event, one of the interesting things about my life is that in every kind of extreme situation, I run into somebody decent. And in that situation where there was total hostility, rigid segregation, great fear, because the trials that were held at night, only the black reporters were there, or everything else was white, and at that time was segregated. I was coming out of the courtroom, and there was this very large law enforcement officer. He had two very big pistols, one on each side, and a cartridge belt. He stopped me and he said, are you a newspaper reporter? I said, yes. He said, he was white. He said, let me see your press card. So I showed him my press card. He said, well, the only reason I asked you, he said, I don't mean any harm, but I have never seen a Negro, in those days, use the word Negro. He said, I've never seen a Negro newspaper reporter, nor have I ever seen a press card that came from a paper. So he said, I just was curious and wanted to see. He said, I don't mean any harm. And I can't tell you how much that did by way of reassuring me as to the role of these people who were there to preserve the peace.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were just totally hostile, ready to shoot you down, mm-hmm. you know, the slightest provocation. But here was a man who seemed really civilized, and
right.
and it was very reassuring.
Good. Well, how did you, we still haven't gotten to how you really got into civil rights as a full-time occupation, and why did you go to law school and then not practice law and so on?
Well, I went to St. Paul, Minnesota after I left
Atlanta.
I had a short stint here in Maryland with what was called the National Youth Administration. Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune, B-E-T-H-U-N-E, was in Washington. She was a good friend of a lady over here, Mrs. Sarah Fernandes, who F-E-R-N-A-N-D-I-S, who was always interested in young people. And Mrs. Fernandes wanted me to come in and try to use the National Youth Administration program for helping young people who are employed, the really low poverty level people, that sort of thing. So I came in, and I was appointed to some kind of a title. I don't remember what it was, but it was for the whole state. And my job was to try to get these young people geared into the National Youth Administration program. But I discovered that while there were a lot of things that the NYA was supposed to do, they weren't quite getting through to the young blacks of that time. And the things that they were getting, in my judgment, really weren't preparing them for anything different from what they had been exposed to all along. Then the head of, well, it was the deputy of the National Urban League, T. Arnold Hill, asked me if I would take a position with the league in New Jersey, I think it was. I told him no, I didn't want to go. Then he asked me whether I would take a position with the league in St. Paul, Minnesota as executive secretary. I went there, and I became increasingly interested, of course, in the problems we had up there, way up there in Minnesota, and got into a considerable amount of difficulty for being a little bit too radical. But I think that for the most part, the people were fond of me. I know I was fond of them.
Oh, there wasn't much segregation in that area, was there?
Odd enough it was. For example, we had quite a fight to get the nurses, black nurses in the city hospital. And we finally succeeded. We had a fight to get black school teachers. We finally succeeded in that. And the first school teacher was a young lady named Rachel James, who looked like she was white. And that was one of the reasons why she was hired, because it was thought that since she didn't look different from the other teachers, wouldn't create too much of a panic. But just as an aside, now, of course, the criteria is to be sure they really are visibly black. But anyway, then we had a fight to get automobile liability insurance for blacks. At that time, the insurance companies wouldn't sell liability insurance to blacks and to Indians. There again, it's interesting concepts that people have of things. By that time I was married, and my wife and I were used to going at things, you know, to evoke mass support.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for example, were trying to desegregate the jobs on trucks that were under the jurisdiction of the Teamsters Union, and the milk driver's job at that time was a very attractive one. Well, we persuaded a company to take a black driver, and
then we were in St. Paul, right?
That's from Minnesota. And that created quite a sensation because it was something new, and we went around and recruited customers for them. But then in this automobile insurance question, we went to the legislature to get a bill passed. The reason I did it is because of former Attorney General had gotten through a bill to prohibit discrimination in the sale of life insurance many years before. Mm-hmm. Minnesota. And he drafted the bill to prohibit discrimination in the sale of automobile insurance. We got a big crowd and we went up to the legislature. It was such a big crowd that it couldn't fit into the hearing room, so we adjourned to the chamber. And I thought we had a very orderly, very constructive hearing, but afterward one of the sponsors said, "Oh, for heaven's sake, don't ever bring that many people up here from now on, because there's a feeling that you're trying to take over the legislature." But we didn't get it through that year, and the reason we didn't get it through, there was a young man from upstate where St. John's College is located. It's a Catholic school. And he thought that because he was from up there, he was immune to any possible political reprisals, and openly opposed the idea, and said, "Well, you can't compel insurance companies to sell to blacks. They have just as much right to discriminate as to say we don't want to sell to people who have a red necktie." But fortunately for us, we had a very good friend, Reverend Francis Gilligan, who was a Catholic priest and at St. Paul Seminary.
Is that G-I-L-L-I-G-A-N?
Right. And he had a lot of friends up at St. John's College. So somehow they got together, and this young man who had blocked us before didn't get reelected. And in the next session of the legislature, observing the caution not to have too many people who might be suspected of taking over the Capitol come up, we started the process and got it passed.
Then basically you got in the civil rights movement just by opportunities arising, and you took over a job, right?
I wouldn't say it quite that way, because what I'm really leaving out is the things that I did on a volunteer basis. For example, when I was a newspaper reporter, I was always the person on the boards who had the job of publicity for the NACP, the Urban League. And
you're on both boards.
That is correct. Yeah. And then I always was involved in all of the things that were going on, so that I guess the only difference was that in the league it was a situation where you were paid, whereas in all times prior to that it was a situation where I was operating Without any compensation.
Well, is there any specific thing that you feel was the motivating force towards your trying to do something about the lack of civil rights for minority groups?
Well, I'm not sure I could say a specific thing.
More a combination of.
I think the general condition was what put me in a position of opposing it. I felt always that this was something you ought to work against. But I sometimes on reflection, I wonder whether my view was simply a racial view, or whether it was more the broad economic problems of a class of people. Because you see, as I said, I came along at a time when you could see people unemployed, white and black, in a state of misery, and when you went to these big rallies that were designed to assert the rights of the masses of people and that sort of thing. So that I suspect that I was as much concerned about injustice per se as I was about
economic injustice.
Well, injustice per se, as I said. For example, I saw right down here on St. Paul Street, in that block just before you get to the courthouse, there was an office of welfare department, and there were some ladies, Mrs. Broadus Mitchell, and I guess...
She the wife of
Professor
Broadus. Professor who's a socialist?
Yes, and he was a professor at Hopkins, you know, an economist,
right,
really.
That, yeah.
I suspect that maybe Mrs. Waxter was there, although I can't be sure. But these were the ladies who were highly respected and that kind of thing. They went down to picket the welfare office because of the way the poor were being treated. And I was standing right on the street when the patrol wagon pulled up, and all these nice ladies were ushered right into it. Carried off with their signs.
On what grounds?
Well, at that time it was illegal for them to picket. And
is there an injunction or what?
As far as I know, there wasn't an injunction. The only thing I know is that they were said they were going to go down and picket. They did,
yeah,
and the
you,
next day.
You picketed during the Buy Where You Work campaign, yeah. Buy Where You Can Work campaign. And you weren't arrested there, so why would these white ladies have been
arrested?
Well,
I think, I'm not sure of the sequence, but I'm certain that under our law at that time, it was illegal to picket in anything other than a labor dispute. And
I see, and this was not a labor dispute, whereas you could say the other was a labor dispute, the Buy Where You Can Work
well,
campaign?
Well, we said it was, but the court said it wasn't, and they issued an injunction stopping it. It wasn't.
What, on the Buy Where You Can Work?
On the Buy Where You Can Work, yes. That was stopped by a Maryland injunction, and that law was not changed really until about, I think it was 2 years later, when the Supreme Court in a similar case that arose in Washington, D.C., held that this was a dispute between the employer and customers, which was sanctioned by the law, and the injunction was set aside. That really established the right of people in disputes of that kind of picket. But as I said, the sight of those ladies getting arrested in the case of the Pennsylvania Avenue pickets, I guess it was too inflammatory to try to arrest all those hundreds of people. So the process there was to serve the preliminary injunction on the people who were involved at Bethel Church. The
right.
Church was surrounded and they presented this. But in any event, it is things like that which I suppose must have made me feel that even though as a black I was exposed to a lot of things, that also a lot of other people were having troubles too. And I've never, as far as I can recall, drawn the line on trying to be with those who were against injustice. I remember I was in Minnesota in a committee called defend America by aiding the Allies, which I, as I look back on it, is probably a very conservative group. All the top townspeople were in it. But the purpose was to arouse the country to the menace of Nazi Germany. And I suppose it might have been in there for decoration. But whatever the reason, I didn't question those who asked me to join, and I did, because it seemed to me that we ought to take up the cudgels against those who were the oppressors.
Do you have any comment about the fact that the whites, many whites, particularly during the Depression period, had much in common with many blacks, and yet there was this barrier of racial prejudice which really kept the two groups from working together? Matter of fact, the whites, the poorer whites, probably felt threatened by the blacks because they would be competing with them for jobs and so on. Do you feel that there was ever any conscious or unconscious effort on the part of some whites to stimulate this prejudice?
Oh yes.
In order to maintain a more conservative political front?
Oh yes, I'm sure that was there.
You say you do believe
that. Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I remember a situation involving the swimming pools here. No, golf course. At that time, this was in Baltimore, and I was...
Now, what date approximately?
It would have to be in the 30s. I can give you the exact date by getting the case, but it was a case where the Urban League and some others got together for the purpose of getting days to play golf at Carroll Park. And at that time, blacks were not permitted to play on the golf course. So the approach of these people was to have certain days set aside. And recall that there was a great deal of protest about it by whites from the South Baltimore area. They went up to the Druid Hill Park office of the park board, or whatever it was in those days. We met in that little house, which is right at the Madison Avenue entrance.
Yeah, I know where you mean.
And there was a huge crowd in there. I was the only black in there, and there as a newspaper reporter.
Now, by the way, who was sponsoring this movement now?
This was by the white leaders of South Baltimore, whoever they were. They were there speaking, and they had a crowd with them. And they were very dignified people, well-dressed, and not the highly inflammatory type, you know, with any invectives. But we all went into this room, and whoever was in charge from the park board passed out cigars. Everybody settled down, and the spokesman for this white group said, well, I thought this was going to be a meeting where we would just discuss our grievances privately. So the man who was in charge said, well, I can't keep a reporter out of here. And they said, well, you're going to let him stay?
Namely you.
Yeah. And he said, well, if he wants to stay, he can. I stayed. Well, then that's when I got exposed to how these differences are promoted. This spokesman said, well, I'm here representing these people who want to live peacefully. He said, and you know, the colored people have a tendency to colonize. When one moves into the neighborhood, another one is going to move in, and pretty soon you've got a colony of people. And he said, then of course we just don't know what kind of disorders and crime we'll encounter having these people in. And of course, his troops, who were probably just as guilty of all those things themselves,
right,
were nodding in assent. They somehow thought they were superior. And when the park official said, well, there's no way I can say that these people can't play golf. And the spokesman said, well, would you go so far as to say that they could swim with white people in the swimming pool? And at that point, my memory is very hazy on what happened. I don't recall anything further, but that was the coup de grace, you know, because this man who was a park official could see that that was a very inflammatory kind of a thing. Then over at the...
By the way, who got the days for Negroes or blacks to play golf on the golf course? Was that the NACP or who was it?
My best recollection is that it was led by Edward Lewis, who was
the Urban League,
but it was joined in by a number of other people. For all I know, I'd have to check this. It may be that when the matter got into litigation, the NACP handled the case. I think it did. But at that time, there were some people who felt that playing golf was a low priority item and they didn't really feel like getting into it. But Ed Lewis was the person, to my knowledge, who was the leader of that effort. And interestingly, technique of getting certain separate days was really a recognition of the separate but equal doctrine and acquiescence to it, which in retrospect seems almost like treason, of course, but in the context of those times, I guess they thought that was what they should do.
Well, did the... all right, so you're stating basically that the Urban League adopted the separate but equal at one time.
Oh, I wouldn't want to say that. I would say that the context of pressing for solutions within the Plessy versus Ferguson doctrine was one which was accepted as a legal approach, but not for the purpose of preserving that doctrine, but for the purpose of eroding it in stages without making a direct attack on it, the direct attack didn't come until later.
Well, you're obviously very familiar with the NAACP. Did the NAACP at any time adopt separate but equal as a viable solution to the problems of Negro-white relations? Of course, I'm talking about the early period.
No, I don't know of any period in the history of the association where it accepted the separate but equal as a proper way of doing things. I'm sure that much of its work was within that legal framework. For example, I would say that when we attack the question of equalization of teachers' salaries, there was not an attempt to break down segregation per se. It was really an attempt to get the black teachers in black schools the same salaries that paid the white teachers in the white school. But there was, and this happened right here in Baltimore, in Maryland, a case which was brought by Thurgood Marshall and others attacking the question of exclusion of black children from schools. This was back in the 40s, I believe, because at that time there were no schools for blacks in Baltimore County,
high school. You're talking about no high school for blacks in Baltimore County.
And they were
saying he lost that case.
That is correct, yes. But it was a direct attack on exclusion on the basis of race, because the objective was to get the black children in the white school. So as I said, I think that to a great extent the association's posture was, given the law which recognizes the separate but equal doctrine, how do you work within that framework eventually to get rid of the law? And the strategy up until the 54 cases was to attack in a way that would erode the separate but equal.
To the best of your knowledge, did Lily Mae Jackson at any time in her life accept the concept of separate but equal?
Never. I don't know of any time that she ever did. Her life was a constant rebellion against anything that represented oppression. I remember a story she used to tell about how when she was in the South, her husband, as you know, was from Mississippi, and they traveled a lot. She went to Mississippi with him, and one of the stories that she would tell was how on one occasion when he was out, a bill collector came to the door and began banging on the door calling for Jackson. So she said, what Jackson do you want? Do you want Mrs. Jackson? And this bill collector said, we don't call niggas business down here, and banged on the door again. She said, I've got a 38 in here. And if you don't get away from that door, I'm going to shoot it right through it. She said he went away. I don't think she had a pistol in there, but that was her attitude, you know. In fact, when you were with her, you could always expect some kind of confrontation if she didn't get a proper treatment.
Well, did her views change then over the years, or they're pretty constant right on through ever since you first met her the day she died?
I don't know of any change in the direction of lowering of the standards of morality or lowering of objectives in pursuit of interracial justice. Her whole life was a fight in which she was inspired, it seemed to me, by a love of combat. Not reckless combat, but...
she liked confrontation.
Oh, she loved to fight, there's no doubt about that. And would, under all circumstances, and no matter what the odds, fight if she thought she was right. And in so many cases, things that she started, which were things against the grain, which people thought were foolish, are now things that we do. For example, the preservation of neighborhoods. She was in an unending fight against non-conforming uses in neighborhoods. And most people would say, well, why would you object to a nice barbershop or funeral parlor or an orderly tavern or pool room or something like that? These people have got to have these things. But she would go out and fight against him now.
In other words, it was not just limited to bars then, because I don't hear about her opposition to the bars. But
one of their famous cases was a rag factory, which was on Wilson Street near Druid Hill, where there was either a mattress or a rag factory, I don't remember which, but whatever it was an improper thing to have in the neighborhood, and that was a big fight which was won. Then she had another fight involving some people who wanted to have a horse stable in a residential area. Incidentally, when I was a boy, we sort of had horse stables and things like that all around. We thought it was very exciting, but now, of course, you realize it's the wrong thing to have in a neighborhood. But she fought against that, and then there was a very great problem with the undertaking parlor that somebody was trying to put in a neighborhood. And then another time she was opposed to a barbershop which was owned by a black who was a friend of the family, but he was trying to put it in a residential neighborhood. So she was consistent in that respect. I guess the taverns were the most spectacular fights because they had money and they could carry out the fight, you know. But she was an across-the-board preserver of residential neighborhoods.
Was she generally successful in this struggle?
I would say generally. There were cases which were lost, but I think generally speaking, she was successful where the law was clearly on her side, and as in cases of so many feet from a school and that kind of thing.
Did she bring these cases through the auspices of the NAACP, or was she doing some of this on her own?
My recollection is she started them on her own, and I think that most of those were on her own and through what they call the Northwest Neighborhood Protective Organization, I think it was called. And this is because the association, to my best recollection, wasn't very enthusiastic about handling that kind of case in those days. So I would say that it's my best recollection that this was a kind of a William Jackson project, probably at a later stage, had the blessing of the NAACP. But
it was through this Northwest Protective.
Well, that was later organized, but she started off personally. Then they organized this Northwest Baltimore Protective Association.
What would you say were Dr. Jackson's greatest strength and her weaknesses, if any?
Well, so far as his strengths are concerned, I think consistency and hard work. She was a woman of almost inexhaustible energy who wouldn't think anything of working on something up past midnight, and this might mean going through the streets to try to find somebody that she wanted to do some particular thing. I always felt a little uneasy, you know, going to somebody's house at midnight to get a bunch of them. But she didn't have any compunction about that. She would call them. So as I said, she had inexhaustible energy. And she had great determination. If she lost in the first instance, that didn't disturb her one bit. She'd come right back. She was very positive, too. If you were wrong, she would let you know and do it in a no uncertain way. I remember she tangled with a bishop of the African Methodist Church who had done some things.
Is that Davis?
Yes. Yeah. And that was a classic confrontation because the white community, the people who were interested in race relations, you know, tended to want to side with the bishop because he was a bishop. But that didn't stop her. She went ahead, and incidentally, she was right. So far as weaknesses are concerned, I don't think of any weaknesses she had. I think of some things which probably were a handicap to her, but really in what she was trying to do. But this really was a handicap caused by having too much of an asset. In other words, she would not hesitate to have a confrontation with the highest or the lowest of officialdom at the time when an incident occurred. To me, that's an asset. But there were many who would desert the ranks when that happened because they didn't want to get caught in a situation where they thought they couldn't win. So I would say that her boldness and her courage and aggressiveness was the kind of thing which caused some people to be a patronage. But down a little further were some other kinds of things which were open for everybody.
Well, they didn't allow the blacks and whites to go in the same bar in those days, did they?
Not at Nordenholtz, because there were no whites going in there that I know of. And I'm sure that the practice then would have totally separate bars.
When did the white churches, would you say, take up the cry of civil rights?
Well, actually, they didn't really take it up until the 60s. On any large scale. They were active in various ways, and various officials, but the mass involvement of white churches in civil rights really didn't come until the 60s.
Another question. In Baltimore, we had sort of a three-pronged attack on the problems of segregation, the churches, the Afro-American, the NAACP. I mean, the Urban League was working, some others too, but frequently you hear this triumvirate, the clergy, the Afro, and the NAACP. Mm-hmm. If you disagree with that, incidentally, please comment on it. But did you have a similar triumvirate in other cities in the United States?
Yes, I would say generally that was the pattern.
What,
but
the
in some
black
cities,
press, clergy and the NAACP?
Right, but in some instances you had added to that people from the labor movement because I know of my own knowledge people from the labor movement who were cooperative in a lot of things, particularly in those unions that had a large black membership.
Of course, in this city, the many of the labor unions were somewhat hostile, weren't they, to the advances on the part of the blacks?
Well, I would say we had a lot of difficulty with certain crafts. Carpenters, for example, we had to organize separate locals, or at least separate locals were organized. The machinists in the early days were reflecting their national pattern and were hostile. Blacks could not become members. They didn't want them working together. It really wasn't until the industrial union movement got off to a good start.
CIO.
That's correct. That you had
And when was that?
Attitude. That would be in the 30s. I was assigned, really, to cover the, as a reporter, to cover the organizing drive of John Lewis and the CIO in Baltimore. So I'm very familiar with what happened at that time. That would have to be in the early 30s.
In other words, they consciously went out and sought black members.
Oh, yes, they did, and played on the fact that the craft unions had discriminated, and that in this arrangement there wouldn't be any discrimination.
Right. Did the CIO have problems recruiting whites because of their appeal to the blacks during that period?
I think they had problems recruiting whites, but I don't think it was so much on the question of blacks. I think there was a notion that they were communists. Apparently, John Lewis and his organizing took everybody who could organize, and there were charges that some of these organizers were communists. I don't know whether they were true or not, but anyway, that, I guess, was one of the biggest handicaps rather than a racial matter with the CIO, but that didn't stop them. They really plowed ahead anyway.
You didn't really comment when I made the statement about the Afro and the clergy and the NAACP, the black clergy, that is, being the primary thrust of the civil rights movement in Baltimore and Maryland. Do you agree with it, or would you want to modify or amend that statement?
I would hesitate either to modify or amend, because when you're looking back over a period of years, sometimes you give unfair emphasis to things. I would say, on the basis of my personal experience, I can only recall two instances where the Afro-Americans seemed not to be on the side of the blacks and things that they were trying to do. In all the 98, they were with them. So far as the churches are concerned, I can only recall a few clergymen. Asbury Smith, for example, is a Methodist, sticks out in my memory as a person who could always be counted on. And Dr. Speer, who was a Presbyterian, does that name ring a bell with you?
It certainly does. He's one of the finest men I know. T. Guthrie Speer.
T. Guthrie Speer.
Do you know he's still preaching on occasion?
No, I didn't know that.
And he must be about 86 or 87.
Well, isn't that interesting? I didn't know that. Well, his name...
Now, was Asbury Smith, was he white too?
Asbury Smith was white, and he was from the Eastern Shore.
But you said you could count on Smith and you could count on Spears.
Yes, these are names that I remember clearly and associate them with specific activities. But it isn't a long list, and therefore I'd have to say that the church identification really was the black church.
Yeah.
That was almost 100%. The black church was very supportive of all of the civil rights activities.
Including Bishop Davis?
Well, Bishop Davis was a bishop, and as such really was trying to suppress the wave of the future whenever he tried to act contrary to civil rights. I'll give you this illustration.
Wait, are you okay? So in other words, he was contrary to the movement, so you didn't have 100% support of the black clergy?
My recollection is I said almost 100%. Yeah. I don't think I did the finality 100%. If I did, I correct it and say almost 100%.
Yeah.
But I would say, with respect to Bishop Davis, he was a peculiar kind of an institution in himself. I think that he liked the status quo, and apparently felt that you could accomplish more by being nice to white people. I used to cover the meetings of the African Methodist ministers held on Monday mornings. I would cover them as a newspaper reporter. My recollection of his speeches to the men when he talked was more or less in the defense of the status quo, and he was very dictatorial. Nobody could challenge him very much, but that did not, in my opinion, represent the views of most of the clergymen. I remember the Reverend David Rice, for example, who got into considerable trouble with the bishop because he was moving against what the bishop was for. Then in Bethel Church, where we had Citywide Young People's Forum, there was a clergyman, A. Chester Clark, who was for everything that we were for, and aggressively so, and finally had a confrontation with the bishop. So I'd say that the bishop was, and for all I know, other bishops might have been the same way, but he was more or less the exception. The clergy, for the most part, would be with us.
Right. You mentioned that the black intellectuals were not actively engaged in the civil rights movement, at least I assume during the early stages.
Well, I would say, maybe it's an overstatement to say they weren't, I would say the majority of them.
All right. Okay. Well, what was the role then of the black businessmen? Of course, they were a relatively small group then, and the black professionals?
I think to a great extent it depended on the kind of business that a man might be in. If he was an undertaker, you could depend on him to take out ads and programs and give money. You couldn't usually depend on him to come to the meetings physically and make a speech, anything of the sort, but he gave the kind of support that was needed. If he had a bank, he was likely to be absent and not, at least on the surface.
You didn't have black banks, did you, except that savings and loan?
We had, there was one bank here, the Wilson Bank. Now, Mrs. Wilson, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but in any event, Mrs. Wilson, I remember, was a great supporter of the movements of various kinds, but I don't recall that Mr. Wilson himself was active. It may be that he was just absorbed with his business, and maybe I'm not characterizing it properly to call it a bank, but anyway, it was a financial institution. Then, of course, the doctors were divided into two classes. There were some, and these tended to be those who were rather good at their profession. And they tended to be supportive of civil rights things. The teachers were supportive, but usually without surfacing too much. And I can't blame them because they were in jeopardy. Well, that would be
about the lawyers.
The lawyers were kind of a big question mark because we really didn't have very many of them, and certainly none who could afford to be too active. But there were some who stood out, as Ashby Hawkins and George Mecken. I wouldn't want to be unfair and not include all of them, simply because I'm relying on my memory. But those who were active were tremendously important because they really would win in most things they got into.
Well, the people who consider themselves part of the black establishment, were they divided too?
Well, I would say the black establishment was inclined not to rock the boat. And the black establishment wasn't numerically strong.
All right, and what period you're talking about now, before 1954?
Well, I guess from my conscious knowledge of it, it would be from the time I became a reporter.
Till when?
Till, I guess, the time I left the city, which would be
1950?
1938. But anyway, I left twice, once to go to Atlanta, once to go to Minnesota. But I think my knowledge would cover the period up until 38, and that's my parking. But my best recollection would be that, I really wouldn't want to be unfair and try to characterize it without checking back notes and that kind of thing to refresh my memory. You know, it's so easy to be unjust, and I don't like to be unjust.
But the thing opened up more, and there was more unanimity, I assume, when we got into the 50s and the 60s.
Well, I am unable to say, because in the first place, I don't expect unanimity among people who have similar disadvantages. I think that the victims of oppression, no matter who they are or where they are, don't become saints and therefore recognize that they've got to stick together. I think they, like everyone else, have divisions. I guess it's the story of the children of Israel making the golden calf all over again through the years with all races and all groups. So I've never really thought of having unanimity, and I don't think it has ever existed. I think you have degrees of unanimity, and perhaps in the period of my youth, the unanimity was at a lower percentage level than it was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. And was there anyone else who did as much, would you say, among these people that we're talking about for civil rights as Lily Mae Jackson?
In my period of active interest, I don't know anybody who could match her. I can't recall anyone. I would say that her the period prior to her prominence, she had a lot of people, and I didn't know them. What I know about them is I knew some of them, but my knowledge of the activity is largely gained by reading with Mrs. Jackson. It was observation and participation which gave me first-hand knowledge, and I can't think of anyone who was more aggressive than she.